Welcome, dear listeners, to another episode of So Very Wrong About Games. My name is Michael Walker. I'm here with my good friend, Mark. How are you today, Mark?
I'm very well, thanks, although I'm a little bit nervous by your sadistic smile. This is promising something. I hope this is not a check that you are later going to cash.
Well, I think it's because of our the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago was so good, it's making me this happy. Like it's sort of sprouted wings out into the Q&A later on. It's that good of a game that it just uplifted my soul and my efforts. And
strange you say that, because from my perspective, the game we reviewed a year ago is so good that it actually makes me sad.
And we haven't played it enough.
Precisely. Yes. So
let's get on with it.
This is a show about board games. We're going to talk about the game we reviewed last year, the as yet unnamed retrospective intro segment to the Eurus. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then our topic, which is the conclusion of our fourth instance of our Omnibus Questions. This is Omnibus Questions Delta Bet. And we look forward to answering the remainder of your questions. So with that in mind, Walker, what did we review last year?
Last year, exactly 1 year ago, we reviewed Capital Lux 2.
Generations. Because there's also Capital Lux 2 Pocket, with fewer components and fewer parameters, but nonetheless fundamentally the same game. This is by Eilif Svensson and Christian Amundsen Osby, which is a team whose work we very much appreciate. They've consistently produced a number of games that we've enjoyed. Among them, the recent Revive, which, for my money, is one of the best Euros of the past few years. And published by Aporta Games, of course. This is the very quick, very straightforward card game of wild special powers and strange kind of bidding. It's fascinating, really. And I've thrown it in the game bag several times to go to events, to go to private events. And I've had a bit of difficulty getting it to the table. I don't know why.
I don't know why either. It's very interesting because you use all sorts of different decks, and the combination of all the different special powers always leads to such a different, unique game state that I enjoy Capital Lux 2.
Yeah, I don't find them... The one downside to Capital Lux 2, if I were to identify it, is that I don't find that the combinations of powers really lead to any sort of emergent game states. Like, for example, when you play a game of Root, the interaction between different factions themselves provides some interesting dynamism. Capital Lux 2 Generations, the powers are all very interesting. I don't find that they interact or connect in a particularly fascinating way. But this is a 30 to 45 minute card game, and there's tons to explore and enjoy. As I say, I don't know what it is. Maybe people look at the sort of sci-fi theming and think it's something it's not, or think that it's, I don't know, maybe they assume there's combat or it's trying to be a 4X thing. I have no clue, but I've tried to sell it, and we have played it since we reviewed it, but I don't think nearly enough.
Agreed.
It's a charming, fascinating game.
We'll play it next week, for sure.
Okay, for sure?
For sure.
All right, that's a commitment. So that is Capital Lux 2 Generations, the game we reviewed last year. Now on to the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
We played G.I. Joe, the deck-building game, Raise the Flag campaign expansion to its conclusion, Mark.
The thrilling conclusion?
Finishing a campaign is something in today's day and age.
What, really five games?
How dare you?
I'm sorry. You're right. You're right. I should be supporting and celebrating your accomplishment.
This is designed by T.C. Petty III and put out by Renegade Game Studios. We had this nice 3D printed aircraft carrier to hold our advantages, because throughout the campaign you get these special abilities. Some of them are bananas. Cobra comes... those are spoilers. Sorry.
That Cobra is in the game?
No. Well, I was about to say something else.
Okay.
Anyway, don't regret anything about it. This last game was yet again full of weird things where it was, you know, now put out all these cards like we already had them, but we didn't, and so we had to go find them in all the envelopes. It was weird, but anyway, we just kept trucking through.
Is this a function of the misprints, or is this just a function that you think of sloppy writing? I'm
not sure.
Tough to tell.
Could be,
there's already been a ton of misprints. Exactly. It's difficult to be certain.
Could be something we did wrong, but I went over the setup again, or, you know, could have been anything.
I understand,
because it's all these different paths you can take, and so at the beginning of the thing, it said, did you do this? No. Did you do that? No. Then put these missions in, and then we are supposed to spit out cards we already had, but we did not have the cards. So anyway, still super fun. you are going on missions. You have all these different vehicles. And in this one, it's just another step of cycling for the vehicles. You get them and then they go onto the aircraft carrier. And then once you use the whole aircraft carrier. And so you get the bonuses of all the vehicles that happen to be on it at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all cycle down into the normal hangar where you use them normally.
I see.
And so that's the extra part for this campaign. And plus, I said, all the different special abilities that are on the aircraft carrier itself, new characters, new stuff.
Overall, what do you think the campaign structure, other than confusion, added to the experience of the deck building game?
Not too much, I don't think. It was pretty much more of the same. The story was a little bit better, you know, because it was more sort of all tied in with this long going sort of storyline that led through all five missions. So that was kind of interesting.
Is it one of those campaigns where if you win the last scenario, you win? Or is it one of those campaign games where you're definitely going to end and you get a different kind of epilogue based on how well you did?
I'm not sure. I was not in charge of the book.
Did you win your last game?
We won the last game.
Okay.
And then on the thing, it said, you win.
Got it.
Luckily, there was a little bit of a debrief at the end, so that was good. But I'm pretty sure you just play that last mission until you do win.
I see. All right, fair enough.
And that is G.I. Joe, the deck building game, Raise the Flag campaign expansion. And then to wrap up this whole sort of G.I. Joe experience, we were lucky enough to get a review copy of G.I. Joe Axes and Allies. So the next time that group is together, we'll play sort of like the cap off of this whole G.I. Joe sort of campaign, and we'll have a session of Axes and Allies G.I. Joe.
All right,
looking
then.
Forward to that.
Got to play the new edition of Through the Desert. This was published this year by All Play, pursuant to successful crowdfunding. The art I quite enjoy. So the art of the map, of the pieces, the overall setting is by Damian Mammoliti, and I quite enjoyed it. I thought it was very well done. And I appreciate the fact that many of the recent printings of Through the Desert, so specifically the Fantasy Flight reprint I have from the late aughts, as well as this edition, are in very, very small boxes. You know the kind of boxes where everything fits, but you have to be a little bit careful about how things go in? I think that's a size of box that more publishers should pursue. So Devir Games does this frequently. Red Cathedral was a shining example of this. A lot of small box game, you know, like NAR does this, of course, but in a small box game, that's kind of expected. I think more large box games could be medium box games, and more medium box games could be small box games. So I very much appreciate that. And of course, everyone needs to know, how are the new camels? Well, first of all, they're not pastel anymore. So they don't all look like Sweet Tarts flavors, which is a bit disappointing. So some of us were operating from stored memory and desperately trying to identify which color of camel is now detergent. There isn't quite a direct analog, which is, honestly, it's a little bit sad, but I guess you can't spend the entirety of a publication history of a game like Through the Desert aping some strange pastel choices made by the original Cosmos edition. The camels are now hollow, which I kind of appreciate from ecological perspective, but there was something very satisfying about those chunky, solid, sweet tart colored camels. So I'm of two minds about that. Overall, though, it is a splendid new edition. Very functional, very physically attractive. The plastic is not quite as good, but then again, you save on that. And there are now two boards, two different boards with very slightly different rules. And that's to be emphasized because Through the Desert, we've reviewed it before, and I commented at the time that to a certain extent, it's review proof. It's so atomic. It's so simple. It is so stripped down to the essence of glorious Euro tile placement that there's not a whole lot of room to riff. Now, there is a set of expansions that Allplay published, a whole bunch of little mini modules. I haven't tried any of them. Some of them look dodgy. Some of them just look strange. Now, they were designed by Rana Knitzi himself, but I mean, whatever. Sometimes you get perfection right, and then you can't alter it without making things worse. That having been said, we did play the alternate board, and it seemed okay as a variation. So perhaps my hesitation isn't warranted. Through the Desert needs to be played more. Of the perennial classics, I think Through the Desert is absolutely one that deserves more attention from everybody. It's one of those games that I pull out one or two times a year, and every time I do, I say, I need to be playing this more, and then my job kicks in, and I have to play other games. Through the Desert is brilliant. And it is absolutely worthy of being perennial in print, and I'm very glad that the new edition is a worthy entrant to one of the timeless achievements of Eurogaming, even though our hobby is usually measured in terms of a small number of decades, so I realize timelessness is very strange, but it was absolutely wonderful. Navigating through hex sides, getting from place to place, trying to connect things. Another thing that I'd forgotten about Through the Desert is how it has a surprisingly complex and nuanced arc, given its relatively short length and simplicity. There's the early game where you're grabbing the low-hanging fruit, where you're directly competing with other caravans that are adjacent to you. There's the mid-game where you then start going for the things that are slightly more out of reach. And then the end game, you start sidling into the end game and you start worrying about finishing off those enclosures. You start worrying about whether your camel chains are longer than your opponent's camel chains. You start competing for those 10-point victory conditions. And I really appreciate it when a game has that kind of texture, that nuance. You don't have to have it in a game. Certainly not a 45 minutes long, but I do appreciate that it's there. So you've got the time pressure, you've got the spatial pressure, the difficulty of getting from place to place effectively. I guess I'm saying it's basically like Mage Knight. Through the Desert by Rainer Knizia, one of his crowning achievements of a stellar career. Glad it's back in print. Thank you, Allplay, for reprinting it. Glorious new edition, Through the Desert.
We got Leviathan Wilds back to the table. This is designed by Justin Kempainen and put out by Moon Crab Games. And what you're doing is you're launching yourself up this giant Leviathan, climbing around, destroying crystals, trying to uncorrupt it. And this time we played with three players, and I thought that would slow it down, but did not. Just the straight-up openness that is Leviathan Wilds, the free-form movement, the passing stuff around, the being able to play some cards whenever you want. There's nothing bad to say about Leviathan Wilds so far.
I agree. I was pleased with how different this Leviathan felt. Every new scenario is a new Leviathan. You turn the page on the glorious Spirebound book, and the spatiality of how to climb from place to place changes. This was a giant spoiler redacted, and so it was very different climbing over that as opposed to climbing over the other giant spoiler redacted. And one thing that I very much appreciated, because I was concerned about the AI cards, you know, the bad things that happen. Every Leviathan has their collection of six-ish, and over the course of the game, some of them are great. You reveal them like, okay, this is where the Leviathan is going to hit us soon. Can we find a way to get out of the way? And some of them are just like, eh, you just get whacked upside the head, which is okay. Look, I understand that co-op games have to have some kind of timer. There have to be a threat there. But this Leviathan had an additional wrinkle where we could start learning the rhythm, the tempo of the various AI cards. And we say, okay, well, that one's already triggered. That means these areas of the map are safer. I, all things being equal, very much would like to end on those areas of the map. And that was great. That was much, much better than just random damage coming in at regular intervals. And so I hope very much that the future Leviathans lean more into that, because it just adds texture and contours to what you're already doing in the co-op space. And I just can't get over how much thematic coherence you get from the movement and the map by virtue of the fact that you're climbing over these giants. And so the glide action, I think we're underusing gliding.
I agree.
Because you can move down much more easily than you can move up, because you know that's how falling works. I studied physics in high school, Walker. I don't know if you know about this, but up is hard, down is easier.
Down is easy.
Down is easier.
And down is sometimes hurty.
That too. You have to be careful. I mean, it's easy. The movement is easy.
Yes.
You know, there may be consequences to it.
The landing.
Yeah, exactly. You got to stick that landing. So I'm very much looking forward to further Leviathan Wilds. I think it's great.
Speaking of looking forward, we did take a little bit of peek. And man, do they add even more sort of little bit of extra mechanisms.
Things took a turn.
That look very interesting, and looking forward to, you know, continue playing this game.
Me too.
Leviathan Wilds.
Got to play Dungeons & Dragons Dungeon Scrawlers, Heroes of Waterdeep. It is a great shame to me that my enthusiasm for Dungeon Scrawlers seems to be roughly, I think this is accurate, twice as much as any other human that I've met. I adore the Dungeon Scrawlers games. And I don't know whether it's just because people think that they're, to quote the words of the great sage and eminent scholar Huey, baby games for babies, or what. But I will throw down a Dungeon Scrawlers at any available opportunity. And it's important to know how long to play. Your time management is crucial. The dungeons in Dungeon Scrawlers Heroes of Waterdeep tend to be much longer than the ones in the Heroes of Undermountain set, the first one. Consequently, this time we only played one dungeon because I look around. It's like, okay, well, let's play Dungeon Scrawlers. And it's like, okay. It's like, all right, we'll just do one dungeon, not the full three. And maybe that's a better way to get everyone up. I don't know. Suffice to say that this is my burden to bear. This is real-time competitive connect the dots. You're racing through a maze with your little dry erase marker. You each have special powers, and every dungeon thing has to be dealt with in a different way. The monsters you color in, the treasures you trace. I adore Dungeon Scrawlers. I hope there's going to be another set coming out, more ways to interact with new map features and new special powers, and I endless enthusiasm for Dungeon Scrawlers, and Heroes of Waterdeep, for what it's worth, is my preferred set, although I'll happily play Heroes of Undermountain at any available time. You know, there's something about that time pressure and the fantasy theme and getting from place to place in this novel way. I guess I'm saying it's basically Mage Knight. So this is Dungeons & Dragons, Dungeon Scrawlers, Heroes of Waterdeep, designed by Vangelis Bagiartakis and Konstantinos Karagiannis, published by Woodskid in 2023. Is 2024 going to be, yet again, the year of Dungeon Scrawlers? Let's hope!
I love it because there's different ways to win, right? It's not always like race to the end of the maze. It's, you could utilize your character special ability and try to score points that way. You could, you know, there's like the way the map set out, you can see a way to get more points that way. Anyway, enjoy Dungeon Scrawlers.
But not enough, Walker.
It's true. Well, they say, Mark, there's a saying, too much of a good thing sometimes is bad. I showed Mark a game called Set a Watch. I've been going on about this game. This is designed by Mike Gnad and Todd Walsh, put out by Rock Manor Games. And it's a very much like a Xenoshift type game. You have a character, you have these lines of creatures, you're playing the puzzle, trying to kill all the creatures by using the abilities you had. We had sort of a cakewalk in this game. It played like none of the other games that I played, which was, I don't know if it was unfortunate or interesting because it went a little bit faster or, you know, winning is always fun, I guess. Not so much as your first co-op game, but anyway, right. I think Mark got a good sense of how the game plays. What'd you think?
I was pretty nonplussed. So in addition to it feeling a little overlong to me, I also thought that Set a Watch was pretty repetitive. Just round after round after round of roughly triggering the same abilities in roughly the same ways. And that wasn't particularly pleasing to me. It's also the case that a lot of the time you're just going to be using your dice results to just do flat damage, which is not particularly interesting or fun. So, for example, I was playing a couple different characters because there's a fixed player count, also not something I'm a huge fan of. My cleric rolls 3d6. One of the abilities is kill all the undead that are visible. It's like, okay, well, you wait to see if there are any undead visible. Are there? Oh, okay, use your lowest die for that. All right. So a lot of the decisions with respect to dice allocation felt to me a lot like that. It's like, oh, this is a 6. This is obviously not the one that I should use for killing the undead because it's the best result possible. Oh, okay, I'll just throw that for damage on something when we need 6 damage on something. All right. And I think that Set a Watch would have been more to my liking if it had had half as many rounds as it did. I mean, Xenoshift is also way too long. But I also felt that the dynamism and the cooperation and the different card effects and the varying things going on.
And then like the creep up, you go from soldiers to super soldiers to giant mechs. So it's at least, you know, there's this churn of getting more toys.
Right. In the context of Set a Watch, every character has 5 abilities, any 3 of which maximally can be equipped at any time. And none of us ever felt any reason to swap out any of the abilities.
Yeah, that's what
was
I mean,
this a function of how easy it was or something else?
No, like I said, I think it was just like the perfect storm. Every time we were supposed to take a penalty because, you know, something out of the graveyard would have to come out. The graveyard was empty. We all pretty well started with, you know, the best possible, you know, abilities that, you know, we wanted to play with. So we didn't have to take that camp action to switch out abilities. We rolled lots of doubles. So when our characters did go to camp, we kept the horde way down. It just seemed to be this cacophony of good rolls and good luck.
Yeah, I don't know that the game would necessarily be more interesting had we rolled badly, right? If, on the face of it, I'm not in a position to comment. I mean, the dynamic of the struggle would have been, I would have appreciated it. But in terms of how interesting the decision-making gets, I don't think that necessarily would have changed had we started rolling badly. And we did roll badly in a couple of rounds. And again, it just, most of the choices seemed pretty obvious. And in a cooperative dungeon monster killing thing, I am more willing to forgive that in a 45-minute experience than in a 90-minute experience.
True. I think I remember reading the new campaign part that I got of it. I think it just goes for 5 rounds instead of 9.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So I think they do short little mini sort of missions as opposed to...
I can get behind that because there was another big problem, which was as the game was being set up, there were these stacks of character cards. And the one on top was this badass lizard dude with a spear who uses poison. And I'm like, oh, that looks great. And Mark's like, no, that's just for the, you can't use that.
Yeah, he's
like,
locked in an envelope somewhere.
Okay.
Let's hope Renegade didn't write the book. We'll never see him.
So did that color my disappointment with Set of Watch? Maybe.
But off to a bad start.
I'm just saying, don't dangle the badass lizard guy, Spearman, using poison in front of my face and then tell me I can't use him. That's not cool.
And that is Set a Watch.
Was shown Mysterium Park. I've been curious about Mysterium Park for a while because it is the stripped down small box version of Mysterium, which is a co-op game that I very much enjoy. This too was designed by Alexander Nevsky and Oleg Sidorenko. And I confess I'm a bit of a Mysterium hipster. This will probably, no doubt, shock people desperately who are unaccustomed to my insisting on having been an originalist about various things. But one of the adduced virtues of Mysterium Park as compared to the original Mysterium by Sidewinder was she specifically said, well, there's no voting. It's like, yeah, I never play with voting anyway because we play by the rules of the original Eastern European version.
Actually.
Precisely. Not just because it's the original version, but also because we find the voting very strange and kind of pointless. I once again am disappointed anytime there's an edition of Mysterium where all the art looks the same. The artwork in Mysterium Park is very good. It's dense. It's loaded with lots of different things that you can make associations with. It's like, oh, well, but yeah, there's a flower in this card. And there's also a flower in the clue that you gave me in an attempt to clue me off. It's like, yeah, I didn't mean the flower. I actually meant the shape, or I meant the color, or I meant the, you know, this, that, or the other. And there was lots of misdirection. I'm not going to say that it single-handedly causes us to lose, but I exhausted all possible options in false guesses before we progressed to the second round.
Yikes.
It was painful. And I prefer the artwork of, in this case, the same feature exists in both the original Mysterium as well as the Mysterium published later, which is to say you have a person, place, and thing, and the art styles of all three are somewhat different. And so you feel that there's a sort of evolution going on. And also, our game of Mysterium Park, partially because I was so bad, wasn't substantially shorter than a full game of Mysterium anyway. So I'm left wondering, other than the smaller profile, what there really is to recommend it. And ultimately, I think that the smaller profile is not nothing, as I've already eulogized the benefits of smaller boxes in this very episode. And I mean that sincerely, but ultimately, I'd rather play Mysterium. So there we have it. Now, a worse version of Mysterium is still a pretty good time. And if you're on a budget, or if you don't want another big box game, or if you just want to try something small before diving in, I really think that Mysterium, to a large extent, is still the best sort of co-op image association thing going. There are lots of co-op word association games, and we enjoy most of them as well. But in terms of image association, I still vastly prefer Mysterium with its sort of Dixit but co-op sort of structure, even though the theming doesn't necessarily make a whole heck of a lot of sense. I mean, look, if a ghost is trying to tell you who done committed a murder, it seems strange that the ghost insists on laying out a certain specified number of suspects in all the details before actually whittling down to the one you're actually looking for. This wouldn't fly in NCIS is what I'm saying. The ghost needs to bone up on some basic forensics.
That's a skeleton, Mark. Ghosts don't have bones.
That would explain it.
Ah, there you go.
Now everything makes perfect sense, Walker. So that's Mysterium Park.
Showed Mark Biohack. This is designed by
Yofiendi D. Indrayana.
And published by Uchipokoya Games. And I enjoyed it even more the second time. Now, the actions are limited, and then your secondary actions, you know, there's only 3 different spots, and the choices, not a huge decision space, but the game only lasts 4 turns. It's like a desperate race to try to get the most out of the cards you have, and puzzling out what's going to get you points, what's going to get you the discounts for the putting out cards to get those points. And I'm interested to play it more and sort of work on that puzzle, you know, faster. What did you think, Mark?
I was thoroughly unimpressed. It was okay. It just struck me as terribly generic, and I really felt the lack of the decision space in Biohack. It does have this potentially interesting multi-stage worker placement element. Stage one is you have three workers and there are five possible places you can go. So you're just picking two places you're not going. Two of them are resource collection spaces. One of them is a space to hedge against point damage. And the other two just, one of them is you get cards. You need to go do that all the time. Another one is just, oh, here, have some money and points. All right, fine, whatever. So you do that. And there's nominally some sort of interesting timing element because you want to activate those workers when there are lots of other people there. So there's a pressure to get that done first. But the pressure only amounts to very marginal gains, an extra dollar, an extra resource of a certain color. And then what you do, once a worker has been activated from one of those stages, you can then send that worker to the other action spaces, which tend to be more interesting. For one thing, they vary from round to round. And for another, they're how you actually put cards out and actually get things done. And so there's a time pressure. Do I activate more workers on the left-hand side, or do I send them out early on the right-hand side? I never felt that really manifest, though. I felt that the pressure to get to the right-hand side was always bigger than the pressure to activate things on the left-hand side first, because, again, the areas on the right-hand side just seemed more appealing. Further to which, I felt that most of the burden, most of the quote-unquote decisions weren't really decisions. It was mostly accounting, because there are six different types of resources, and there's a huge tableau of cards that you can acquire that need varying amounts, usually some two to three different kinds of resources in varying amounts. Like, okay, this one needs two yellow, three green, and a blue. Okay, this one needs two gray, a yellow, and three red. Okay, so I need to go and get the necessary resources to play these cards out. I spent more time calculating resource costs and trying to figure out those things than anything else, which is appropriate because, again, so many of the action spaces are just get some combination of the various colors of resources. True. So ultimately, I felt that the difference between Biohack and something like Everdell is just in terms of cognitive load of calculating resource differences. And that, to me, does not lead to a better game.
I thought it was very comical, the different areas you went to, right? It would be like you go to the zoo and you get like this plethora of different DNA samples.
Yes.
Or you go to the prison and you use medicine and you get a bunch of primate DNA.
Yes, simian DNA.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
Who knows? I just like, I love the fact that I left it open.
So that was funny.
Different unique places and the stories you can come up with are hilarious. And like I said, I realize there's very little decision space, but four actions. I think once people, if everyone knew the game, it would go like probably 45 to 30 minutes, I think.
Really? I don't know, because there's a number of atomic little elements, and again, calculating them in your head. Yeah, it's a worker placement tableau builder game. I've yet to play a worker placement tableau builder game where I really felt it's like, yes, you have made this better than the good tableau builders, or you've made this better than the good worker placement games. I didn't feel the pressure of worker placement or the interesting trade-offs there. Again, it was just like, gather a bunch of resources. And the cards, overwhelmingly, the cards are mostly just a function of endgame points. That's largely what you're doing. Some of them have special abilities, but those I really felt were marginal rounding. I had one card that said, you get a point every time you go get cards. Well, sure, I got that in the second round, so there are two more rounds left in the game, so that's two more points on top of the six that it's worth at the baseline.
So you have three rows, much like Wingspan, you have three rows of creatures that you're going to put out. The top row is all going to modify the action spaces that you go to. The second row is going to give you discounts on all future cards that you put out. And then the last row with the most expensive creatures are going to give you endgame victory points.
Yeah, but they all give you endgame victory points. The ones that give you special powers will give you, say, 6 points at the end of the game, plus an extra point every time you go to visit this place, which is going to be, you know, 2 to 3 points-ish. The middle ones that give you discounts will also be worth a flat number of victory points.
True, but the ones at the bottom are like 6 points per other creatures you have out, so they're worth a lot more victory points.
Not by that scale. It's more like 3 points per other creature you have out, or 4 points per particular color of creature or what have you. So ultimately, yeah, it functional. There were some decisions to be had, but most of the time I just felt like an accountant, and I'm just not sold on worker placement and tableau building games. If you want something that's slightly heavier than Everdell, that's very much like Everdell, this might be your game.
And the art's nice. Creatures are cool.
The creature, it's There's a lot going on in those creatures. I feel, I'll echo what I said last week, I feel like it's a bit of a missed opportunity. I think there needed to be some sort of city destruction. If they'd leaned into the theme more, because, yeah, there's clearly a sense of humor going on about, you know, visiting the prison and coming back with primate DNA and coming back from the zoo with a suitcase full of dead animals. Other than that, it's just very procedural and joyless.
Semi-agree. That is Biohack.
Got to play Mage Knight, Walker. Played Mage Knight, the board game, the Vlada Kvatl design from 2011. Met somebody who said that he had a very, very long list of games on his shelf of shame, and one of them was Mage Knight. He said specifically, well, you know, I made it halfway through the rulebook a bunch of times, but could never really get through it. It's like, oh, I can teach you Mage Knight, no problem. It's so similar to all the other games, and easy to come back to. And sure enough, we set it up. We started on a Blitz campaign. I do like the Blitz scenarios. I think they do a good job of showing Mage Knight in all its glory, but at the same time without necessarily the commitment of a new player being sunk by their early poor optimization. And ultimately, teaching the game was very smooth, as it often is. If you have someone running Mage Knight, because a lot of the complexity is about corner cases with respect to different things that are going to show up on the map. And if you have good reference sheets, namely, better than the reference cards that Mage Knight comes with, this is rendered a lot easier. I've tried a variety of different ones over the years. There are some pretty good ones on BoardGameGeek. You can go print them up if you have access to such a thing. And other than that, it's just mostly a function of here's how movement works, here's how combat works, there we go. The rest is on the map. Which is non-trivial, but there we have it. So it's great to be once again embark on a career of being a semi-immortal badass, as one does in Mage Knight, of morally dubious slaughter of various things on the countryside. Hey, you may be saving people from a dragon one turn. Maybe next turn you'll burn down a monastery. Who knows? And great card effects, wonderful little toys to play with. Sometimes the problem is in Mage Knight, and again, this is one of the reasons why I like the Blitz scenario. Sometimes you just get a very, very slow start, and you're just stuck with your opening resources, and it can feel like an awful lot like a slog. But ultimately, if you get a couple early levels, certainly the first level quick enough, then I think that Mage Knight takes care of itself. So I was very happy to show it to somebody, and very pleased that he seemed to enjoy the experience. We're going to be finishing our session of Mage Knight in the coming week, because one of the benefits of having a gaming table is that you can easily start longer games and just leave them set up under the eaves if you're so inclined. That is my first half of a game of Mage Knight, the board game.
Mark and I got to play Word Traveler. This is a review copy given to us by the designer, who is Thomas
Dejeuner L'Espérance.
There you go. Wonderful name. He has designed many things that I enjoy, like Wayfinders and Decrypto. And this is put out by Office Dog. And what you're doing is it's very close, to even boiled down further code names, but completely cooperative. And so you have this grid of all these pictures, and they're all sort of dedicated to a certain place, say London or Tokyo, and you all start in the middle, and then you're sort of planning out your move using arrows and words, and then your teammates look at your little setup, and they try to move your pawn around the way you wanted it to move to collect points.
So, for example, you might put in a couple words like communist and not punk, and issue a direction, say north. And so the job of your teammates is to look at the various pictures that are north of where your current position is, or where they think your current position is, and try to find the picture of whatever object, place, or attraction in whatever city is best described by communist and not punk.
Yeah, and you can sort of look ahead to sort of cross-reference and say, well, if they meant this, then what's the next clue? And is there anything that, you know, coordinates to that, and you sort of lock down, and they have a very much similar sort of code names card in their little passport that, you know, designates which spaces are good for points. And I think they got the timing of this game so perfect. You do one round that has three where you're playing down three arrows
steps, yeah.
Or three steps, and then you do the second day of five steps, and then the game's over. And it's just such perfect timing. I enjoy Word Travel. I've played it on Board Game Arena. I played it now a couple times in real life, and glad I got it.
I enjoyed a great deal. The one downside I have with it is with respect to the scoring. And in Codenames, we've all been in that position, if you played Codenames enough, where someone issues a guess and it's correct, but it's not the thing you were trying to clue them into. It doesn't happen all that time. Most of the time, if someone goes off script or someone picks a word that you were not cluing on, most of the time it's going to be either neutral or belong to the opponent. In Word Traveler, it seems, certainly from my first play, that it is very easy to rack points up accidentally. And indeed, in the second round, the team incorrectly identified 4 of my 5 clues, and yet we still scored very well, just because the map is sufficiently dense with point scoring locations compared to the size of the board. I don't know if there's an easy way around this, but it felt unsatisfying to score so many points off of people completely misinterpreting the clues that I'd laid out. It certainly drained a lot of the interest from it as a cooperative experience.
Now that you said that, I'm sort of wishing it was exactly like Codenames, where there was that one black spot.
And if
they remove the person's pawn there, they like fall down a manhole or or you know, trip on a curb or something like that. I think it would be awesome. Maybe I'll go in with a black marker and just put a black random black square on every clue card.
Quite possibly. It was especially strange given that there were so many errors on my clues. We nonetheless scored the maximum possible score. So
true.
I don't think that the difficulty levels are properly calibrated, if nothing else. But I agree with you. It's perfect length, fundamentally good spin on the formula. I enjoyed Word Traveler.
Those are the games we played this week. Now, quick break to pay some bills.
It's all too easy to spend over $100 a month on streaming services. Netflix, Disney Plus, Prime, you name it. But if you use ExpressVPN, you can cut back to just Netflix and save a bundle every month. You can use ExpressVPN to change your online location to over 100 different countries and access the unique media libraries available in those regions. No more having content hidden from you. ExpressVPN is unobtrusive, fast, works on almost any kind of device, all while protecting your privacy online. I've been hearing rave reviews about Scavenger's Reign, and thanks to ExpressVPN, I've been watching it on American Netflix. Like anime? Well, pretend to be in the UK, and you can watch the original Cowboy Bebop, not that other version. It's so simple. You just open the app, select a country, and refresh your browser to be wherever you want and watch what people in your country normally can't. So go for it. Get access to more and pay less. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/sowronggames. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/sowronggames to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free.
And we're back, and we're going to go to the news and why it doesn't matter. Mark, Regicide Legacy is now on crowdfunding. We have talked about Regicide lots. It is a standard deck of cards that you can use to play.
Oh, nothing Regicide. About it is standard, Walker.
True. They do have their own custom cards that you can use.
I will not countenance pictures. This peanut erasure.
And now there's going to be a full Legacy version. The price tag is a little high, but you get 12 sort of mini games that put a spin on the Regicide formula. And, you know, it's like a campaign Legacy type game. I'm looking forward to giving it a try.
Badgers from Mars, I think, through their work and even through their attitude towards the community and their approach to business, has earned all the credibility in the world for a second release. And so I am more than happy to support them as best I can in this campaign for Regicide Legacy. This is independent of the fact there's actually a caricature of me on the campaign. The campaign page is really worth visiting, even if you don't have any interest in, well, first of all, if you don't have any interest in Regicide, what's wrong with you? But the artist, Sketch Goblin, has done such consistently stellar work, both in the game and outside the game. Sketch Goblin has redeemed a whole bunch of memes that I thought were tiresome. The Regicide versions are delightful. I'm a big fan of what they've done with the artwork there. There's also, quite unexpectedly, a caricature of me making me look appropriately hideous, I think.
I disagree. I think
yeah, there's a difference of opinion.
You're looking out into the distance. You have this look in your eye that you know what you're talking about. And the fact that they actually got that look on your face is quite amazing.
The smug look of certainty?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Did it sculpture well those passions red, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed? Anyway, please do go and check out the campaign page for Regicide Legacy. I am very much looking forward to it. I'm eagerly anticipating this release. If Badgers from Mars are able to capture even half the magic of base Regicide, we're in for something special. So that is Regicide Legacy.
And lastly, people must like Dune: War for Arrakis, because Simon is bringing it back up on crowdfunding. It is game bound. But anyway, the typical, you know, here's a new expansion. And guess what? You can get everything else again. So if you missed out on Dune War of Arrakis, you have another opportunity to get in on the bottom floor and give it a try. It is a sprawling, giant, plastic troops on a map Dune experience.
You're not much into the Dune license, are you?
Oh, no. Oh,
you're a Dune guy?
I am a Dune guy.
Oh, okay.
Yep. I watched the second movie just recently, and I was immediately on the interweb saying, how do I get number three now?
Well, Denis Villeneuve is incredibly talented. Did you know that he tried to have one of the Fremen say Tabarnak in the context of the movie, but he wasn't able to do it because the actor wasn't able to say it properly?
Oh.
Yeah. He feels a great sense of shame.
Yeah, fantastic movies. Just for the timing, the pace, the music, the sound, everything. Ooh,
The pacing is the one thing I would not praise Denis Villeneuve for. But I'm surprised you're not interested then in trying War for Arrakis.
I think I'm just so over with these
four-hour
games.
Yeah, a person only needs so much plastic in their lives.
Yeah, like I would want to, like someone said, let's play Dune for Arrakis. Dune War of Arrakis. I'm there.
Sure,
I will play it. Me wanting to buy it or. Or
have to deal with
own it.
Yeah.
Or deal with it. Yes.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Fair enough. That is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now on to our topic, which is Omnibus Questions Delta Bet. This is the remainder of the questions that we can seek to answer. Now we've had to, I should specify, we've had to cut a number of questions for time. That's not to say that we don't find them interesting. We've cut some from content. Again, not necessarily because we don't find them interesting, but because there are certain things we would rather not disclose and rather not get into in public. We value our privacy a great deal. We respect your curiosity, and we're going to indulge it as best we can. So on that topic, the first thing I would like to address is a number of questions about SwagCon. I was knee-deep in preparations for something resembling SwagCon a few years ago when a series of family disasters befell us, and I've been traveling. Well, the past 6 months have basically been the first period of non-travel for years. And I've talked a lot more about this in Bloat and various other Patreon content, but suffice to say, I was very seriously traumatized by the constant dislocation I had for a couple of consecutive years. And then the death of my father compounded that. And so that completely scuppered any plans that I had for a SwagCon. And I'm not in a position to commit to anything imminently, but I do very much want to revisit the topic again sometime in the future. But there was going to be one, then a whole bunch of things happened. I'm not the man I used to be. I'm still recovering. And once that happens, I will endeavor to make sure that we can have something resembling a SwagCon. And specifically, what I kind of sort of have in mind, this is pursuant to a number of polls that we ran a few years ago, and a lot of people gave us their preferences, something like a 2.5-day con of some moderately small size, with the swag cannon being proffered by us somewhere in Kingston. It would be in Kingston, not because we think Kingston's an ideal place to host a convention, but simply because at least it's not too far away from the major Canadian cities on this side of the globe, and also because then we would be able to do things like provide a games library and things like that. Anyway, so more news hopefully to follow sometime in the coming years with respect to SwagCon.
Mark.
Yes.
What is your favorite reprint? Where they nearly got everything better, and the game that should always be in print.
Tigris and Euphrates. Specifically, the 2007 Pegasus Spiel Edition. I like the artwork. It is, for my money, the best balance of attractiveness and usability in any edition of Tigris and Euphrates I've ever played. Because, as anyone who's played Tigris and Euphrates knows, you have to be able to eyeball the number of tiles of different colors in every kingdom. And so you need to have a certain amount of bold colors around the outside, but by the same token, you want the tiles to be attractive and have some sort of evocative picture in them, some kind of artwork in the interior without obscuring that clarity. This was also the first edition that had the double-sided board and the additional variants. So for my money, the 2007 Pegasus reprint. Matago then did a French version a couple years later with the same assets. But it's the edition that I have, and it's my favorite reprint. And Tigris and Euphrates should always be in print, and it is a Shonda that it is not in print.
Cool story. Never heard of it. My game would
don't
be...
Don't ask if you don't want to hear the answer, comma, Walker.
Yeah, I'm hoping for a Bake-Like Tile edition. Wouldn't that be...
I could probably get behind that. But again, it would depend on the artwork.
Yes, for sure.
It's tricky.
Mine would be Project Elite. I think CMON did a great job. They made the miniatures nice and blocky, not too sharp, nothing breakage. They have a wide variety of characters.
A lot of the characters are pretty garbage.
They are, but at least it's a wide variety.
Yeah.
And the art is good, and the maps are nice, and they did some work with some expansions.
Which are also a little garbage.
But at least it's a little sort of side venue that you can explore once in a while to be different. Good dice. Everything about the production, I was happy with. Project Elite.
Good stuff. Walker, what is your favorite and least favorite Carl Chudik game?
I think Innovation, I guess, would have to be my favorite, even though I don't play it that much, but out of his games. And then he did a Bear Attack game that was atrocious.
Yeah, that was one of his non-Asmodee games. I do not like Carl Chudik's non-Asmodee games other than Glory to Rome. That was the follow-up question. And my favorite Carl Chudik game is definitely Innovation as well. And my least favorite is, of his Asmodee games, it's probably a GNC. And there's not, and pretty much all his non-Innovation games, other than Uchronia, I don't think any of them are worth playing, frankly. And Uchronia only because it's a dim shadow of Glory to Rome.
Mark, what is your favorite shape of die?
I like D12s. I like how they look.
Yeah. It's not quite pretentious as the D20.
Yeah.
Kinda like, look at all my sides.
Yeah.
Right? It's
12 is enough.
12 is enough.
And it's so versatile.
I like how War Room went from the D6s to D12s when you're rolling for all the troops.
Mm.
You know, it's the same. It's just like, you know, it's like a D6. But
yeah, they you can use a D12 better for almost anything. I really like how Root used them for D4s because, again, quoting Mike Hutchinson, D4s are gross.
D4s are, in fact, gross.
So do you have any thoughts on prismatic dice? Those are the long ones with the numbers on the sides?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan. And then there's stick dice. Throw a bunch of sticks. Have you ever used stick dice?
No.
I've used them a couple times. It's fun. It has a certain degree of spectacle. It's, you know, kind of.
Yeah, I like when they're more like in the theme. We've seen a lot of things, you know, the B counters from Aperary. They're not actual dice, but, you know, that kind of thing where you're like rolling something that has sides.
That's true.
That's locked into the theme. That's usually pretty cool.
That's true. Relatedly, what is your favorite custom die used in a game?
I think it would be the Formula Day. I think they just did such a great job.
Mm.
The feel of gears, the totally custom sides, how they're all the different gears of your car. And I think they did a great job on it.
I have a tremendous weakness for a certain variant of prismatic dice that was used in Warfighter. There are six-sided dice that are the same shape and size as a 9mm bullet, and they have D10s that are the same shape and size as a 7.62mm rifle shell.
Yikes.
And they're not very functional. You can't really roll them because they'll just roll forever, so you have to kind of plunk them down on the table. I'm still a big fan.
Yeah, D6s are my favorite, I think. Non-rounded edges, just straight up.
Fair enough.
All right. Besides Nikki Valens and David Thompson teaming up, what other board game designers would you like to see work together? And what kind of game would you like to see it be?
My dream team would be Reiner Knizia and Matt Gertz. I have no idea what specifically kind of game they would make, but they have relatively similar design idioms with subtle differences. Matt Gertz is a little bit more about tempo, and Reiner Knizia is a little bit more about math. But if they could harness their powers combined, now part of the problem is that Reiner Knizia seldom does collaborations, and when he does, I often don't like them as much as his solo work. And Matt Gertz doesn't do collaborations really either, so this would never happen. But a man can dream.
I want to see a Reiner Knizia, Eric Lang area control game.
Oh my goodness! I don't even know how that would work.
It would be amazing.
Well, I mean, they basically did. It's called Ankh. I mean, that is Eric Lang being as Knizia as you can get,
it's
while
true.
Still being Eric Lang. I guess then the answer would be, the other question would be, what is Knizia being as Eric Lang as you can get while still being Knizia? Possibly Blue Moon, even. Or maybe Lord of the Rings, The Confrontation. Maybe one of those. But yeah, why haven't Nikki Valens and David Thompson done a board game together?
Because they hate us, Mark.
Is that why?
Yes.
Okay. Are we done with Oathsworn because Mark has soured on campaign games?
Yes. Well, I think Mark, well, as much as everybody else does, there is a guilt to not finishing campaign games. So Mark has thrown the baby out with the bathwater.
What?
And decided that there would be no more campaign
games. I thought you were going to back me on this.
What fun is that? That's not content.
I thought you are going to back me up. We are both sick of campaign games.
It's true.
It's not me. It's not like everyone else is like, let's do this. I'm like, do we have to? I was a little bit like that with respect to the ending games of my city, because my island, because my island was wearing on my nerves due to the way that it was progressing and the way the game was working. But Chip the Third wanted to finish it in relatively constant succession. I was dragging my heels a bit, but I was willing to bend to the demands of the group. I am not the one standing in the way of finishing other campaigns.
I would like to get back to Oathsworn.
I would too.
I would like to get Frosthaven to the table.
Starting Frosthaven, I'd be happy to do that.
And also, there's one that you will not play, but one that's coming soon. Tidal Blades 2, I'm definitely going to try that. So,
I don't know. All the Tidal Blades games have been so different. I might be willing to give a shot.
Yeah, we'll definitely play. I definitely want to show you at least the first game, just so we can see what kind of mechanics they use. So, yeah, we'll get back to it. I have a feeling the way this year is going so far about playing older games, about having less new stuff constantly coming in, I think there is a chance that some campaign games will get back. And the fact that we just finished a G.I. Joe campaign. Anyway, yes.
True. What does it mean for a game to age well? And what are some games that best represent this?
All right, so games that have not aged well, and why haven't they aged well? I'm talking about games like Talisman, games like Clue, games that have mechanisms that take away from the fun, like the movement in Clue, the drag of having to roll around and try to get to the different places. The Talisman, the same thing, just sort of the grind of going around and around the circle. So I feel those are games that have not aged well. Mechanics that just are outdated.
I would add another roll to move game, Merchant of Venus. I love Merchant of Venus. Richard Hamlin is a genius. I will tolerate the roll to move. The thing that has not aged well and that no game I think could get away with now is the amount of math involved. Like, you're doing all these transactions where there's a 10% gratuity to whoever owns the space station. So I'm selling this for 40. Okay, he pockets 4. She pockets 3 from this. They pocket 7 from over here. No.
Now for some games that I think have aged well. I think the Axe and Allies games tend to constantly perform. I believe the combat system they had worked well. And much like Diplomacy I have down here, the way Diplomacy did combat.
Absolutely.
The way they did negotiation, I think Diplomacy still holds up. I believe it's a extremely confrontational game. So maybe that part of it doesn't still age well, but just the mechanisms as a whole were fantastic. And I have Space Hulk here. They did so many interesting things in Space Hulk. It is so old. The timing of the turns, the command points, the stress level it creates, even without the timer, just the gene stealers flowing in and the chess-like maneuvers that you have to do sometimes. Anyway, those are the games I have for games that have aged well and the reasons why.
I mean, I'm not going to shock anybody. Most of Knizia's output from the 90s has aged super well. And for a more recent release, although this isn't super recent, I would say that, you know, for what it's worth, Mage Knight has aged pretty well. It is one of those complex games where you can't really point at a whole bunch of stuff and say, that's just needless cruft. That's just there for the sake of busy work. And maybe the differentiation in terms of sites could have been simplified and pared down, but that wasn't a function of its age. That was just a function of some of the design remit, as well as things like Hans of Teutonica. Hans of Teutonica feels like it's from, in a way, it felt like a throwback at the same time as it felt kind of progressive. And it's, you know, I don't feel that a lot of the contemporary game design innovations, as it were, are necessarily forward steps. I'm not here to say that there was a golden age and everything's bad now and back in my day things were better. It's just, you know, if you look at some of the recent trends, I don't necessarily know that they're adding considerably to the value of a lot of game experiences.
And this next question sort of leads into
precisely
that. Would you rather play games released? So would you solely play games released before 2020, or would you rather solely play games released after 2020? I think we might be different on this. I don't know. I would always play games after.
Really?
I'm always in for new stuff, you know, innovative things, something different, something new. Even though I enjoy the older games, I just enjoy, you know, figuring out where the designers are going and what they're trying to get out of, you know, a tabletop game.
That's entirely legitimate. I would choose before 2020 only because it would allow us to finally, A, clear all backlogs, and B, finish all those campaigns.
Yes.
And C, always have enough time for, again, those perennial classics from the 90s. But I can certainly understand where you're coming from. It would be a painful decision, but my choice would be only games before 2020. Walker, have you ever had a game give you an actual headache?
Oh, I'm sure. I don't know a particular one. I'm sure it was a Lacerda game. But I'm sure that I don't have any stories. I'm usually pretty chill when we go to play games. Nothing really gets me too worked up.
Calico. I had a physical headache while playing Calico.
Yeah, that would do it.
Yeah. The game is, the design of Calico is very, very good at eliciting what it wants to do. And it's not for me, and I just, yeah, physically hurt my head.
Mark, if you had the time, money, and stuff for another hobby you don't currently do, what would it be?
I've said this before, I could see myself becoming a car guy, figuring out how cars work, installing mods, tinkering. I wouldn't necessarily want a lot of cars. I certainly don't think I'd want to maintain more than one car, but I could see the virtue in spending a few years tuning up a car and modifying it and getting it everything the way that it wanted, having a workspace to be able to do things like, paint touch-ups as well as installing things. Yeah, I could see myself finding that pleasurable.
Mine would be actual video editing.
Ah, sure.
I know we do put out some videos now, but they're very minimal, sort of just like cut off the beginning, cut off the end.
Right.
We did some big video reviews before where I actually did.
That's how we got our start, yeah.
The fun stuff that I did. It's not Terry Pratchett. What's the artist from Monty Python?
Terry Gilliam.
The Terry Gilliam stuff I was
doing. Sure, sure.
That kind of stuff I really enjoyed, and if I had the time, I would 100% do that.
Certainly. Have you played Pitch Car, Walker?
I did. Years and years ago, I was at a convention, probably Gen Con. Mm-hmm. I saw they had loops, Mark.
Yes.
There are Pitch Car sets.
Oh, there's Pitch Car, all manner of things. Ramps and loops.
Total loops. So I was there.
Yep.
Played a couple rounds. I don't remember very much how it did. I'm sure it's a dexterity game.
Yeah.
I'm sure I had a ton of fun. And I'm sure as usual dexterity games go, I have a mission.
Flick as hard as possible.
And that is to get around the loops. And
sure.
So it probably happened.
I've played Pitch Car a number of times. I like it. I don't love it. There are two major problems I have with Pitch Car. One of them is just the bulk and expense. Another is that the ratio of failed flicks, you spend a lot of time not doing anything because you can't cross the ramp. You can't finish the loop. You can't get around that corner. You're constantly going off the track. So you spend a lot of time not doing anything, which I don't find as enjoyable as other dexterity games.
Just get good. Seriously.
Probably I should get good. Walker, what's your favorite tabletop RPG?
Durance, I had written down here. I think my last experience with Durance was so good that I haven't had a better one since.
Yeah, you talk fondly, though, about Paranoia.
It's true.
It comes up a lot.
It does.
Yeah, yeah. I've never played Paranoia, and I played a lot of Dangerous Journeys, which was actually Gary Gygax's last big complicated thing. I think it was the second to last game design. I have fond memories of it. I don't know if it would hold up.
True. I will contact my Paranoia guy because he's...
You have a Paranoia guy?
I do have a Paranoia guy. Well, the old Dungeon Master or...
Sure.
Or game whatever, master, yeah. Game Master, whatever Paranoia was. And he's down for holidays, so I'll throw the idea and see if he wants to, run a Paranoia game. And maybe we'll get one.
Because it's well-suited to one-shots, right?
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought so.
What is your favorite thing about making a board game podcast and your least favorite thing? And would you recommend to anyone making a podcast?
Well, my favorite thing is Michael Walker, but I don't think it's polite to call him a thing, listener. I don't know why you put it that way. It's nice to have a little bit of structure to our conversations about games. It's nice to have an outlet for that kind of discussion. Not that we weren't... Not that this precludes us discussing it in other contexts or we wouldn't in other cases, but there's a reason why people schedule things like book clubs and schedule things like having a fixed time to go do and thing, have a thing you enjoy. And so that part is great, honestly.
Yeah, the same thing that's what I often say was the reason, right? Our conversations after a game, I just wanted to expand on that,
right,
and give it structure. And now it's, I don't want to say that I need an excuse to play games, but now it's sort of like, well, I have to. So I'll now go play games.
Well, again, having kind of structure to your hobby experience, yeah. Would you recommend other people starting a board game podcast?
If they have the time, yeah, I don't see why not. If you really enjoy doing it, I'd recommend anything to anyone.
Sure, sure. Like many things, it would depend on why you're doing it. I perceive cynically that some people enter certain endeavors for clout. I don't think that's a good motivation to do anything, really. Well, maybe some things, but I find that if your goal is to get close to and start rubbing elbows with the right people and to start being able to exert influence on other people, maybe stay out.
Probably.
Also, we don't need the competition, so nobody should start Board Game Podcast. In fact, everyone else should stop.
Agreed. Of all the accessories in our hobby, Mark, inserts, playmats, game tables, expansions, which is the most important, which are simply superfluous?
I think a well-done insert can be a joy. A well-done insert can be the difference between a game that is too painful to set up and a game that is a breeze to play. And a recent example of this is Mage Knight. I have a great foam core insert for Mage Knight. The biggest thing about Mage Knight is you need to organize all your monster counters. That is the one huge thing that needs to be done. The inserts that come with Mage Knight do not do the trick. And there are some games that come with published inserts that are fabulous. And it doesn't even have to be a game with a huge quantity of components. Like, Wolves had a great insert with spaces, slots for all the player decks. It's like, here's your player deck. Here's your player deck. Just pick it up and chuck it at somebody. Some games don't need inserts at all. You can just put everything in a baggie. Fine. But proper organization of game components, particularly as the number of game components increase, I'm a massive fan of.
Yeah, I went through a playmat phase.
Yes.
No longer. Done with playmats. Although I saw that I shared it on the Discord server. Just so people know. Say if you have a lot of playmats, Mark.
Yeah.
A wine rack. It looked glorious. They had this metal.
That's a great idea.
Wine rack, and they had all their play mats in there. It looked great.
Yeah, anyway, so moving hard on. To store, yeah.
Past that, and expansions. Always love expansions. Always have a nice twist. It's nice to have some extra stuff.
And as for most superfluous, look, some of you take communion at the Church of Sleeves. That's fine, and that's fine. A lot of people prefer sleeves. That's great. That's good. Some people like the peace of mind they have from having sleeves. There are some people, this is as much as I will say, there are some people who insist that any card game needs sleeves or will somehow spontaneously disintegrate from contact with ambient air. This is not true. Sleeves are almost never required. I mean, obviously, a lot of John D. Clare's games need sleeves or they don't work. Fine. Yes. Past that, pretty superfluous.
I think it depends on how. Well, I'm just thinking. I do. I used to do it.
Yeah.
And I not anymore. Maybe it depends on how big your collection is. Say if you have a collection of three games.
Sure.
So you're bringing the same three card games to every game night, and they're getting played a lot.
Sure.
Now there is an argument to say, well, if you play the game enough and that you wear the cards out, then it's justified that you just buy another copy. Or you could say it's just justified to sleeve them, and then you won't have to buy another copy. I don't know.
So my copy of Race for the Galaxy has been played in excess of 100 times. Had I sleeved it with decent sleeves, it would have cost almost as much as the game itself. And number one, I don't have to replace it. And number two, if I did, I'd still be saving money. That's all I'd say about that.
Mark, who are the Gibbons in the swag mythos?
We don't. We should. We can't.
Well, see. We went and we saved them from the Frumpalumps and the Doowangles. Okay, sorry. I said too much already.
Which games generate the greatest difference of opinion between the two of us?
Oh, I have two-player card battlers.
Really?
I think so. I don't know what else. That's what I got written. I couldn't think of anything else.
As in, which one of us likes them better? Or
you like them and I hate them.
Okay, well, as a generalization, I don't think that's accurate, because you like Mindbug, you like Radlands, we definitely...
Sacra Arms, there's many I like.
Sacra Arms, I think, is the biggest point of overlap.
Yes.
But Battlecon is one I like and you loathe, there are a couple of others. You enjoyed Battlecrest, so yeah, there's some overlap.
There is.
I think the biggest area of disagreement is highly social talking games.
Oh,
so
true.
So your Sidereal Confluence... Your Resistance, most social deduction games in general that are not Scapegoat, any of the ones that involve lots and lots of talking, any games that involve lots and lots of deal-making, I tend to like them, you tend to hate them.
True.
There you go.
Five favorite movies and TV series.
I don't think we're going to get to five. Walker hates... The moment you put a number on it, he refuses to play
it.
I
don't even have any close. I don't even think I have... Yeah, I don't even have a
single... I don't think he's seen five movies.
I don't even have a single movie here. I have three TV shows.
Okay, sock it to me.
All animated.
Sure.
There's a new Star Wars one. Not new.
Below Decks?
No, that's Star Trek.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry.
That's okay. That is very good, too.
That's embarrassing.
Below Decks is amazing.
Okay.
But I have Bad Batch. There's a show called Bad Batch. Uh-huh. It's about this, you know, rogue stormtrooper clone unit. I thought they did a great job. Very, you know, they do bring in a regular every now and then, but it's mostly sort of like on the comms. You know, he's talking to Admiral whatever,
right,
but never really have to interact with them. So I thought that was great. Ranma One Half, of course, is just a classic.
Oh, really? I didn't know you were a Ranma guy.
Oh, yeah, I've downloaded that multiple times. I've always talked about, you know, Adventure Time and Rick and Morty. Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
But that's not here. It's the one that I think you and I both enjoyed this. I enjoyed it maybe more.
Kimi no Todoke.
Yeah, Kimi no.
From Me to You.
Yeah.
I liked the manga. I found the show a little too slow paced. But yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, those are the ones I have here.
Favorite movies, Old Boy, Memento.
Oh yeah, a movie. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, Mark.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Aliens.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
There you go. Done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. As far as TV series go, Friday Night Lights, 6 Feet Under. We talked about anime before. Yeah, you know, in no particular order. Could we get a more accurate, less tongue-in-cheek portrait of the other swag dramatis personae? No. We gave them aliases to protect their anonymity, and there we go. Would you rather play a straight minis game or a minis in a box game?
I've switched to minis in a box, I think.
Yeah.
Just it closes down the rules, I think. It just makes it more, you know, based and even for everyone.
Based,
and you get a little based just so.
Yeah.
And you get a little out of control when you start going with these open miniature systems for what I'm doing now.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's very much a lifestyle thing. And it's very much a community thing. If there are locals, if there was a local scene that played Gaslands, I'd play Gaslands all the time. But there isn't. And so anytime it's time to play Gaslands, I'm responsible for all of it. And that level of overhead, much more accessible and much more approachable to be able to play a minis in the box game. Would we consider doing a segment dedicated to playing and reviewing old classics from the good old days, a.k.a. from 5 to 50 years ago? I'm pretty... I don't want to pat myself on the back or anything. I think I'm pretty proud of the fact that we seem to do that a lot more than a lot of people. And over the course of our normal coverage, we talk about older games with a fair degree of regularity, and I wish we did it more, but that's also just part of our playing schedules.
True. But yeah, like, do we want a dedicated segment for it?
Yeah, I don't think there'd really be a need, frankly.
No. What have you both trained to do as a profession, and what have you done as a profession?
We've done many things for money.
We said we wouldn't talk about our OnlyFans, but here we are.
It's true. As has been, I think, mentioned many times on the show, I was trained in philosophy, and for a while I was a philosopher. I've also been an actor. I've also been a debate coach. I've done a number of things, and now I'm a podcaster.
Electrician, general contractor, baker, podcaster.
There you go. Walker, do you have any true grail games? A game that's out of print, rare, or otherwise very difficult to obtain that you would like to have?
This is what we call a callback, Mark.
Yeah.
I had this blank. It was like, no, I've had all those games, and you move them out of the house. I had the Broadsides and Boarding Parties,
mm-hmm.
the Queen's Gambits,
yep.
the World of Warcraft,
yep.
the Coffin Games, the StarCraft, all of those games were in my collection, and they're all now gone. The one that I would like to have is Capital Lux Generations.
All right. I think I can make that happen. I have talked about this on Bloat. Over the course of the past few years, acquired all the Grail games that I wanted. I don't have any Grails left. There are lots of games that I'd like to have, but none of them are really Grails. Walker, do you think that Fred Ford and Paul Reiche 3 still have the juice after 30-odd years to pull off a worthy sequel to Star Control 2?
We're going to find out.
We're going to find out. I don't know. I'm skeptical, but I'm willing to give them all the rope and all the runway they want.
Yeah, I'm sure like the hardware will be there, right? And so at least we'll get a dogfighting...
Yes.
Space game.
I'd be surprised if they mess up the Super Melee. Exactly. Yeah.
So at least we'll get that. And as for the story, well, we can hope.
So the next up, I'm going to confess, I mostly just want to criticize a presupposition in the question. I'm sorry about this. And basically, the last part of the question is, is it always desirable to have games appeal to a wide variety of intelligences? It's talking about pitching games to different playing cognitive levels. I want very much to disambiguate an attachment and association that many people in the hobby have between ability to play games ability to understand rules, or ability to be competitive, any of those three, with intelligence. Let us stop talking in those terms, and let us understand that playing games in general or a specific game is just a skill. And if you don't have a certain skill, or even if you can't acquire that skill, that does not reflect on your intelligence. I don't even think it's worth talking about intelligence in the abstract anyway. That's a whole thing. But there's this assumption that a lot of gamers have. It's like, oh, I play my hobby is a very erudite one. This reflects very well and only in a certain... I'm not saying that this is true of the questioner, but this is an attitude that I think that underlies a lot of assumptions. And I think it is noxious and one that we should try to avoid. Now, should a game be necessarily pitched to as many audiences as possible? Not necessarily. I think the great thing about the hobby is that you can make things that are super niche. Like an example that is simultaneously approachable and super niche is something like For Science. For Science can be played by lots of different people with lots of different skill sets, but nonetheless, it is super niche. It's a real-time cooperative dexterity game. How more niche can you get? And on the other hand, something might be vastly more pitched to wider audience, like strategy gamers, but nonetheless not be approachable at all, like something by Vital Lacerda. This is not knocking on Lacerda, just using him as a proxy for complexity. So
we should get like a Vital Lacerda sort of like...
Gong?
Epithet.
Oh, like an effigy. Yeah. Oof, no. I have nothing against the man.
No, not... This is all in... tongue-in-cheek.
I know.
All right. Mark, would you sit for an interview with another game channel?
Sure, I have in the past. Not recently.
I wouldn't do it like if it was about our show or about me.
Oh, sure.
Like a topic or something, yes. But yeah, nothing like an actual interview with me, no.
So there have been a number of questions about philosophy, and I'm just going to answer this one directly, and then I'm going to generalize for a little bit. Would you say that the categorical imperative is roughly equivalent to the golden rule? No. It is, in point of fact, entirely different from the golden rule, because the golden rule is premised on your desires, whereas the categorical imperative is precisely in opposition to, or not in opposition to, independently from any desires you might have. That's why it's categorical, because it applies independently of whatever desires someone might or might not have. I will be talking more about philosophy in a 3-part special episode. So very wrong about all the games you like bad on the Patreon feed. So all the other questions that we got about philosophy will be addressed therein. Walker, you didn't give me a stink face once during that, so I must have been good.
I had so many things. That it's like, yeah. And right after Mark's, like, I'll have my 4-part series. No, I'm not even going to say it. I have like 4 brutal topics that I can't even say. Anyway.
Thank you for holding your tongue. I was able to get that through without you rolling your eyes too hard. I must be getting slightly better at limiting my duration.
So someone wants to know if they should buy Oak or Revive. And I feel that there's not enough context, like, you know, what they're
doing. You would, yes.
Yeah, there's no way to know.
Okay, which game do you prefer? How's that?
If I had to have just one of them, I would choose Revive.
Oh, I'm surprised. I would have thought you would say Oak.
No, I just like the puzzly nature and just the more, I'd say, I don't want to say difficulty. I don't know.
Mm. I would choose Revive as well. As I say, I think Revive. Oak is a stellar game.
Yes.
Oak is very much worth your time, but if you can only afford one, I would choose Revive. I feel that it's slightly more open. Oak's got a lot of toys, but it doesn't quite have the same level of openness competition.
Yes.
I think that Revive has.
But much better than I did.
Walker, do you have any trouble watching or listening to yourself when reviewing things that you've made yourself?
Well, Mark, as we all know, I go over and over all of the content that we've made.
Walker's being sarcastic here, I think.
No, I don't have any real trouble with it. I just usually don't do it. If we have mostly all the editing, Mark does all of the editing for the podcast. I do some editing for our Pledge of Indifference, and so I sort of know how the recording goes. I know if we needed a bunch of stops. A lot of times there's none. So like I said earlier, the video editing now is chop off the front, chop off the back, and I'm done. And so I don't need to listen to any of it.
I found it a little odd, like many people do, to hear my voice recorded, but I quickly got over that after, you know, even just a few months of the early days of the podcast, and so now I find it very easy to do. I find it hard, as I've commented, to see myself quoted in text. I think any time when speaking extemporaneously and someone takes a pull quote, I think I sound like an idiot, and I'd prefer written remarks in those contexts. And as far as watching stuff that I did when I was an actor, I was never a very good actor. So, yes, I find it a little painful to watch.
The pull quotes that I love the pull quotes because there's so many things we say and the things they choose
I know.
Are hilarious.
It's I don't understand it. All right, final question. Steven Universe question. And indeed, since no one has asked any Steven Universe questions, how do I feel about the handling of the Diamonds as the endgame villains? They're probably the most controversial aspect of the show. I actually find most of the controversy that I've read about is actually about Bismuth's representation. And I'm very sympathetic to some of the racial overtones that are implied by Bismuth and a number of other things that happen in the show. I'm not familiar with these specific controversies. I will say this about the end. Once again, no criticism. I reject the premise of the question. The Diamonds are not the endgame villains of the show. The endgame villain of the show is Steven's trauma, because the end of Steven Universe is about Steven processing his own trauma. And that is far more villainous and far more daunting than the actual Diamonds are, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm sorry I can't address the controversy because I'm not familiar with it, but I think the ending was borderline perfect, as befits a show of its quality, because of how it didn't shy away from, it didn't just treat Steven as a messiah figure, which he was. It treated him as a flawed individual who was dealing with an enormous quantity of pain. So that's going to do it for Omnibus Questions Delta. That is going to call it a day. Thank you so much for your participation. Again, if we didn't address your question, very sorry. We had a lot to get through, and we tried to synthesize as much as we could. And without you, none of this would be possible. Thank you so, so much. Thank you also for spending some time with us. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find all our information at sowronggames.com. We read everything you send us, and we'll get back to you if we can. We hope to see you again soon. Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoeseteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.